into sports.
20 yards out, Urch to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
And get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him. Yeah, no.
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports. Ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network.
The Football Show on Off The Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. See WWE.net.
I'm prepared to anything I can.
Well, do it then.
Come again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Now, very happy to chat to our next guest about his career. Currently one of the most tactically astute pundits around. He was the same as a player. 600 plus senior professional appearances in the game. He came through at Crewe, where he made his senior debut at 16 years of age. And then he joined Liverpool at 20. He was there, obviously, 1997 through to 04. He was part of that treble-winning season. Went on to Charlton and Spurs before an Indian summer at Fulham. Five great years there. Captain for that famous run to the Europa League final, amongst other things. 9 caps for England as well. I am, of course, talking about Danny Murphy. Danny, great to have you on. Thanks so much for the time.
No problem at all. How are you?
Very well. I should have added scored the winner against Manchester United about 400 times as well, I presume. That comes up.
Yeah. They were special days. Yeah, I do seem to get reminded of those goals more often than any others, strangely enough.
I think it was 01, 02, 04, if I'm not mistaken. That was a bit nuts, that run.
It was crazy, actually. I look back now with great pride, obviously, but the coincidence of it being at Old Trafford all the time, I don't know whether that came from being a Red growing up, a brother who, well, I had 3 brothers, but one of them was a United fan, so my hatred for United grew from an early age. But no, it was a good stadium for me, Old Trafford. I actually made my England debut there as well, and funnily enough, probably one of the most memorable Liverpool games I had at Old Trafford was my second ever start for Liverpool. In a 1-1 draw, I don't know if you recall when Michael Owen got sent off in the first half for a silly tackle on Schmeichel. And I ended up getting man of the match. And I played a lot of that game up front on my own. And the only reason I played in that game was because Karl-Heinz Riedler actually pulled his back, getting his bag off the coach on the way to the game. So my memories of Old Trafford and my experiences there started off very positively. And it just carried on. We did take one or two beatings there, but who doesn't in a career, as long as I had. So, yeah, it was a special place for me, Old Trafford.
I mentioned with your punditry, you always strike me as somebody who has a leaning towards tactics. And I always enjoy when you're on Match of the Day, for instance, because, look, other pundits might single out a player and show how that player played well or whatever. But with you, I often get an overall sense of tactically how this game was won, lost. That seems to be a leaning that you have. Did you have that as a player?
Yeah, I was very fortunate. I started understanding and wanting to understand, I think, is the most important thing, tactics at a young age when I was at Crewe. Good coaches there. Dario was a huge influence in that. We used to play in different positions most weeks and really try and start to understand what's needed on different areas of the pitch and also trying to understand what's needed from others around you. So I was always a thinker. I always was looking at why, asking why, trying to think of ways to change momentums in games or change my own position. I was always querying things. I think some of that just comes naturally. I don't think it's something I set out to do. And then as my career got better and working under some fantastic managers, Julio being another one who was very tactically aware, you know, I advanced my knowledge in being able to, you know, see things, I think. And when you play top-level football for a long time, I think that's an important aspect of your game, is being able to understand when to be positionally right, when to play more free, you know, how to guide others. And it wasn't probably till my Fulham days where I really felt comfortable and strong enough in my own skin to be able to have an influence on others. I had a wonderful relationship with Roy Hodgson, who gave me responsibility on the pitch. Sometimes I'd change things on the pitch with his say-so, you know, swap the wingers or drop a forward back into midfield, whatever it may be. And when I watch football now, it's not something that I have to consciously do. I'm always looking for the tactics. Sometimes it's a bit of a hindrance because when I'm not working, I just want to enjoy the game and I find myself looking at, why are they playing that way? Change this, change that. You know, it's just something I've always enjoyed. And you've got to be careful when you're doing the work I do not to try and find something tactical that isn't there. Sometimes there's a game where it's just two teams matched up and it's poor, or two teams are just playing free and it's not so tactical. It's just about the endeavour or the quality of the players. But yeah, I appreciate your words on that. I do try and add a tactical element because I think it's important. The viewer sometimes maybe gets to see or gets to hear what isn't obvious.
Mm. Crew, obviously in the headlines for all the wrong reasons, which I might come to towards the end of this conversation. But that's fascinating what you mentioned about playing in different positions. That's quite progressive for 1990s, you know, British football. That's almost Ajax model.
Well, it's funny you mention Ajax, because when Dario took over Crewe and started setting up the youth policy, I think the Ajax model was one they used in many ways. My development there was really good in terms of the coaching I had compared to other clubs. I'd been at Wrexham, Sheffield Wednesday, Aston Villa, Liverpool. And when I went to Crewe, it was a whole different ballgame. I'd never had coaching like it. Lots of time with the ball on your own. And then the stuff I'm talking about in terms of developing you as a player, I mean, sometimes it was protecting me. I was obviously a good player. And when I played in the ages up, there's a physical element that you have to be careful of. So I remember playing in the Crewe reserves when I was about 15, still at school. And, you know, a lot of ex-senior players, big lads, blokes, men, proper men. I called them proper men when I was a young lad. And Dario put me in. I remember playing, probably three or four games. He played me as a sweeper. And he said, look, stay out of trouble. When you feel comfortable, come out with the ball, get into midfield, dictate the play, dictate the game, use your passing. Mm. Stay out of any trouble. Don't get involved in... And then when I played in the first team, I started on the left of a three up front. Then I played as a 10. Then I played in a midfield three. Then I played holding role. I played... All these things were educating me while I was on the job and I didn't really know it. So I was very fortunate to have that guidance, and that club had the foresight, or Dario especially had the foresight to use those techniques and training methods to develop players, because that's what they had to do to fund the club's future.
Wow, that's an incredible grounding. So when you get the move to Liverpool, and I know there was, you know, Kenny Dalglish on the phone and you thought it was your mate and you had to hang up with him a few times. So eventually you find your way to Liverpool. I think it's quite interesting to go the way you did. So at Crewe for 4 years, and there were a number of promotions, but, you know, you're really finding your feet at senior level. To go from Crewe to then a Liverpool. I always think of that Danny Welbeck clip when he's a kid and Roy Keane is showing him how to shield the ball. I don't know if you've seen that at on YouTube or whatever, but Danny Welbeck was always around Carrington. You know, he was used to that calibre of character and that atmosphere. You probably really noticed the change between a Crewe and a Liverpool in the 90s. So what was it about those players at Liverpool? What was it about Liverpool that was different to a Crewe, which I'm sure was still full of very good footballers, but it's a different level, obviously?
Well, there's a few aspects. One is obviously everything's better, more well done. The food's better. The training gear's better. The pitches are better. Everything's more advanced. And more importantly, the players. A lot of the players at Liverpool were at the top of their game, not evolving players or players on the way down, which is what you got at Crewe. So all of a sudden, I was thrown into a set of circumstances where I'm not just only around really tremendous footballers with full of confidence and self-assurance. I'm actually around a lot of footballers who I admired and supported and went to watch, which is a really, really difficult dynamic to grasp. Mm. It's one of my first days at Liverpool. I actually was doing some fitness work and I'd be doing some pitch runs, and I did them with John Barnes. Mm. Now, I can't really put into words that for me, because John Barnes was Kenny Dalglish was my first hero, and then it was John Barnes. Mm. And here I am at Melwood doing my fitness work and chatting away with a guy I idolized. And I actually think, looking back, it took me a while to feel worthy of being there, rather than a competition winner. I had confidence in my ability, but I certainly don't think I was egotistical or arrogant enough to think I was anywhere near. I felt lesser than those guys. You know, even being in the dressing room, felt nervous. You know, what do you say? What don't you say? And so many of them were good guys, you know, really tried to help us young lads. And I suppose what helped me adapt was that I was very lucky coming into the club at a time when Carragher had just got in the team, Michael Owen, Davy Thompson, Stevie G was just starting to edge into a first team squad and training. So we were all in a bit of a similar position. Mm-hmm. The only difference being is I'd come from that lower league club. So maybe I appreciated it more, but I it definitely took me a while to feel worthy.
Yeah, I'll bet. And that first day, do you call him John or Barnsley? What, Mr. Barnes?
Well, obviously called him John at first, and then he was like, no, Digger, call me Digger. But I felt uncomfortable calling him Digger, I have to be honest. It was too familiar, you know. I just wanted to, like, say thank you for even talking to me. But yeah, it's good memories.
So what's Anfield like then, a rocking Anfield as a player when you're, you know, you settle down over the years and you're settled into yourself and in your mid-20s? That must just be difficult to even verbalise when things are going well.
I think one huge advantage for me, and I think other lads feel this as well, is when you've grown up supporting the team and you've been there on the cop, or you've been a season ticket holder, you've been hundreds of games, it's not new. So although there's a different dynamic because you're a player on the pitch, that feeling is, I've had it before, but it was as a fan. And then you have to just channel that energy and that excitement into trying to put in a performance. But I certainly think growing up, going to the game, helped my ability to be able to perform at Anfield. I saw a lot of players come in who took a while to adapt to Anfield. Mm. People who went on to, people like Steve Finn and Vladimir Smyser, that type of name, tremendous technically gifted players who'd been around, who played high-level football, but really struggled their first year or so to adapt to Anfield because of that atmosphere, that excitement the crowd creates there. So, yeah, it's a magical place. It's I don't know if you've been the game there or you're on a European night or whatever it is. People have their own love for their own affinity for their own clubs. I get that. And everyone's got their stories and their memories of going with their dad or their brother, whoever it may be. But that you'll never walk alone, even if you're not a Liverpool fan, on an evening where there's 50,000 in there, it's a special feeling, special, special feeling.
I remember even Roy Keane in his autobiography said it was a very football savvy crowd as well. They understood what they were watching in a very good way.
Yeah, that's been said about Liverpool supporters for a long time, and I actually think it's true. It's hard sometimes to be objective.
Sure.
When you're a Red, but I do find that the Liverpool supporters, unlike some of the others I played for, were a bit more understanding and got it a little bit more. But I suppose as intelligent football fans watch every team. It's a passionate city. It's steeped in tradition, and obviously one of the things that Liverpool supporters are, well, people of Liverpool, that includes Everton supporters, with the tragedies they've had, there's a togetherness there. And once you're part of the family, once you're in it, they'll back you. Mm. You know, you might get the odd game or the odd disgruntlement if you're not at it, but generally they're with you, even when it's not going well. There's a lot of support and love around that club.
Your time there really just coincides with the Houllier era. You joined in 97, he's there in 1998-04. I think a lot of people were struck at the time of his passing when you spoke about him so warmly. Like, it went way beyond just player paying tribute to a manager he had worked under. I mean, it was very, very heartfelt and very sincere. And it's really not overstating things to say he has shaped your life in a massive way, shaped your career, especially in that settling in period.
Well, it was after the settling in period, to be honest, that he came to the fore in my life and career. There's two aspects of football management, I think. It's guiding players, educating players from a football perspective and educating them from a life perspective, a moral compass, if you like, a pathway to living a better life and giving your all and doing the right things. He was a very intelligent, caring man who decided, thankfully for me, to show great faith in me. And I suppose at the time, I didn't see it as well as the clarity came after, looking back and assessing with hindsight what he did for me and how important it was. Because I can say for sure that without him, I'd have still remained a professional player and probably a Premier League player because I had talent and ability. But he made me understand how to get the best of me and how to conduct myself properly, because I wasn't conducting myself properly. And he maintained consistency with me. He didn't just get me to a level and then leave me. He stayed with me. And he didn't have to show that level. You could argue that's his job, but he went well above, over and above what he had to do right. as a manager with me.
What would be an example of that, Danny?
Lots of examples of that. I mean, it's about, on numerous occasions, there would be, I mean, one occasion I've talked about, which is some things were going on and a few little troubles and things happening away from the field. And unbelievable awareness from Gerard when he pulled me in one day, which wasn't that unusual to pull in and have a chat, say how well you're doing or talk about a game or whatever. But he said to me, you know, you okay, you all right? And I was like, yeah, I'm fine. And he said, well, you know, you haven't shaved for a week. You didn't say good morning twice this week. You've not trained the same. You're looking a bit scruffy. I'm here. Talk to me. Like, what can I do? What can we do? You know, so I opened up to him about a couple of things and just got the most brilliant, warm response, some help and some guidance with some issues. And I know other players have spoken about that too. And then following it up as well, you know, not just the one conversation, the attention to detail he would give. He would remember birthdays of your children. He would remember, you know, it wasn't, at the time, they don't seem like big things, but it just makes you feel part of it. It makes you feel wanted. It makes you feel like you want to run through brick walls for him. Mm. So, yeah, there was lots of examples. He was a special man.
Mm. Looking at your, say, when you really get going and get moving, 1999-2000 season, just league appearances, say, to give people a sense of how things were going for you, 23 in 2000, 01 it was 27, 02, yeah. 36 appearances, 03, 36 appearances, player of the season actually in 03, 04, 31 appearances. So he gets you in a really great place. Is he hands-on in terms of tactics and, listen, go there, do that, do this? He seemed like he was, you know, very on top of that side of the game as well.
He wasn't hands-on as a coach, but he was always watching, and he was the one who dictated what he wanted his coaches to do.
Right.
He was a wonderful talker. The meetings, group meetings, motivating. But yes, very tactically aware. So the messages would come through the various coaches we had over the years of work ethic, communication, good shape, hard to beat, defensively sound. We'd work on positional play. You knew your job under Julio.
Right.
And where he was really thorough was the opposition. You know, no stone left unturned. Actually, to a degree, sometimes that annoyed the lads, because it's like, you know, we're playing West Brom, Gaffer. Come on. but he was very tactically aware. I mean, the only tiny criticism from him tactically at times was that we did at times feel like we could have let the lead off a little bit. We were very defensive minded, but that is ultimately why we got our success. When you think back to the teams we beat to win the treble that year, you know, with the quality of sides we come up against, we should never have been competing with, really. And that was to do with tactics. So he was, yeah, in answer to your question, he was tactically very, very good, but he wasn't a hands-on coach, no. Mm. He wasn't a hands-on, but he was there, always watching. He had a presence.
I mean, you're playing as well across this period with some legendary figures, aren't you, really? I mean, you mentioned Barnes, and there's McManaman there, and there's Fowler, and then you're into the Gerard era, and some kid called Michael Owen comes along and does pretty remarkable things. I mean, that's a lot of talent to be surrounded by. Give us a sense of who made the biggest impressions on you. I know it's unfair to pick out individuals, but you might give us a sense of playing with a Gerard or playing with an Owen.
Well, first and foremost, my first season there, where I was on the bench a lot, played a few games, it was McManaman and Fowler were the guys I was in awe of. Michael was flying, but Michael I hadn't watched as a fan and looked up to in the same way. Michael was kind of on my journey, just breaking in and setting the world alight. Michael was. I mean, he was phenomenal, but Michael was more, he felt more of a friend, whereas Robbie and Macca were idols to me. And what was amazing with the likes of Robbie and Macca is how integrated they made you feel and to bring you on board with them. You know, it was, they became friends, Robbie especially, because Macca left, he went off to Madrid, as you know. But with Michael and Stevie, the journey we went on together, it wasn't like I ever sat back and thought, wow, I'm playing with Michael Owen or I'm playing with Stevie G. They were just Mo and Stevie, you know, it was... They were my mates. They were the lads on the journey. We were on it together. It was only later when you look back on your career or when you've left that you think, wow, you know, I miss playing with those two, for example, and Carragher as well. I mean, players like that, you take for granted when you're playing with them. You know, you could have a bad game and Michael will score a couple for you and win the game and you get subbed after 8 minutes and you get a standing ovation because Michael's won the game for you, even if you've played badly. Stevie could drag you out of a hole, you know, on his own. We've seen that many, many times. And Carragher was a brilliant influence on me because he was always behind me and he was a brilliant talker, Carragher, even from a young age. So I never really looked at them maybe how others did because they were with me on the journey and they were my mates.
Yes, yes. I guess Stephen Gerrard was your roommate, I think, so it's hard to be gazing across at the other bed saying, my God.
Yes, that's very true. And then to be honest, at times, it would be the other way around. It would be, I'd be looking down on him, getting sick to death of whatever, you know, he's staying up late watching some whatever, The Office, or like, go to bed, will you? You've got a game tomorrow, you know. Stevie was very grounded. He was just a young lad who enjoyed his football. He didn't understand what he was becoming in that moment. So I don't think he ever, at that time, we shared a room and spent so much time together on and off the pitch. I don't think he ever thought about what he was actually becoming.
Right.
And you know, because he was a superstar.
Yeah, incredible. At that period, did the likes of a Carragher and Gerrard, you know, so we're talking 01, 02 and 03 and 04, did they start taking over the dressing room a bit then?
We did.
Who were Danny Murphy's lieutenants?
Well, there was me, Stevie, Carragher and Michael.
Yeah,
we were thick as thieves for a while. You know, that was a solid four who were quite. We became more influential, but we. Do you know what? We were learning as well because we had the likes of Sammy Hippier, Dietmar Hamann, Stefan Hancho, Gary Mack come into the four, and they were teaching us. You know, we were the reason we succeeded because we weren't egotistical young lads who thought we'd made it. We weren't thinking we were above our station. We weren't allowed to. But with the recruitment the club made and the players Fulier brought in, we found this lovely balance. And the balance was that we were hungry, determined and talented young players with this mix of very professional, talented senior boys who guided us. And they fed off our energy. So it was a really nice balance for a couple of years we had, and it really felt great to be part of it. But that was credit to the management.
Second in the league 1 year as well. I mean, you could be remembered as just a cup team, but like it was getting very serious there for a time.
We went fourth, third, second, and we were aiming to improve, and we were a bit sloppy actually. A couple of games I think back where we shouldn't have lost, and actually the focus, contrary to belief, was the league. You know, we weren't trying to be a cup team. Obviously, some of the mistakes were made in recruitment, which happens. You know, they took a risk on Diouf instead of getting an Elka. I think that was pivotal. I think it's a regret that we didn't understand and realise at the time how close we were that year. We had it in us, and we didn't quite get over the line, but still proud to be part of that squad, even though we didn't quite win the league, because obviously we were coming up at the time against two wonderful sides, weren't we, in United and Arsenal. And you have to give credit where credit's due. They were two phenomenal football teams.
Yeah, it was some era. What kind of personality were you then, Danny? Because this period at Liverpool has the potential to be not quite carefree. It can't be carefree because there's always going to be some pressure, but it can be just like thoroughly enjoyable. I've got my other three mates here, similar age, things are going well, manager likes me, I love the manager, you know, there's a lot to love about that. Whereas often you can talk to footballers and they can say, oh man, I was just worried the whole time, I was stressed, I was reading what people were saying about me, I was worried, was I good enough? You know, it's your perspective is everything. So what? How did you find those years in that sense?
The majority of the time I was very happy, very focused, enjoying my work, loving going into work. Wasn't worried or anxious about anything. I was wary and aware of competition for places and the other players, you know, the likes of Nick Barmby, Patrick Berger, Smyser, Gary Mack came in, Redknapp was already there. There's a lot of midfielders, you know, Juffy came in. A lot of people who were playing in similar positions. So I was aware of the competition, but actually the majority of my time was just feeling very confident and comfortable in my own skin. I was probably at some points too comfortable. A couple of spells I look back where I dropped my levels, I was probably in a comfort zone. Julier talked to me about that a couple of times and I didn't heed his warnings. You know, being in a comfort zone means that you're a bit too comfortable in playing, in your surroundings. You start thinking you're a little bit better than you are. You're not putting quite the same graft in at training. You start getting a little bit cocky because you've had some success. That happened a couple of times, and that was due to feeling part of it. That was due to being in a good place. So yeah, it was a wonderful time in that respect. Nice. You didn't have the social media aspect then either, you know, that concern you're talking about people judging your every game and every move.
Yeah. It's amazing in football, there is no stability. So just like that, a man called Rafa Benitez rocks up. And I hadn't realised he was so, I mean, you can pick a euphemism here and say honest, but like he was straight to you, it ain't happening here. You're never going to be in my first 11. I'm bringing in some guys. I think Alonso and Garcia, his arrival was imminent. And he said, even if you get in the odd time, you're not going to be in the team for a sustained run. Just like that. And I mentioned you were player of the season in 03 and probably peak years. So, I mean, that's devastating.
Yeah. But I have to take some responsibility myself. It took me a long time to do that in terms of I still had a choice. It felt like I wasn't given a choice, but I did have a choice. And I should have had more belief in myself. The big dilemma I had was I'd always felt wanted by Julio. I'd always felt cared for, you know, appreciated.
It's hard to give that
and
up.
And then of course I had other managers who wanted me, making me feel that way. And then I had this Spanish manager who'd come in who I didn't know. I'd worked with him for 6 weeks and I actually thought we'd started getting on. I'd started playing well in some of the preseason games. He actually did an article in one paper praising me, would you believe?
Okay.
And then I had this guy in front of me saying, you're done, basically. And it took me a while to say, well, he gave me his honesty and he gave me his choice. And then I had mine to make. And I should have stayed. And then if a year later I hadn't played and he was right, I could have left then.
Yes.
I suppose ultimately I didn't have enough belief in myself that a year later of not playing would have put me in a position to be able to get the clubs who were after me and the contracts that were being put on the table. Maybe that was part of it, but people think I've got this, the man who lets you go from the club you love, you're always going to have some bitterness towards, but it's gone. I understand football better now. Rafa's a tremendous manager, did a great job at Liverpool, and I was a casualty of a new manager coming in. You know, I've shook his hand since, I've met him since. It is what it is. I do think now is that takes a strong manager, to be honest, with someone like me who loved the club and grown up loving the club. And I'd rather that, looking back, than someone who tells you something to your face that isn't true just to try and then goes behind your back and does something else. So there's some respect there for him and the job he did at the club. But yeah, it was a devastating moment because I never saw it coming. You never do.
I know you went to Charlton, and I know you especially enjoyed your first year at Charlton, but do you remember watching the 05 Champions League final, you know, behind the couch, you know, hands on your head, or was it okay, or do you even remember?
Do you know what? I do remember. I watched it on my own.
See, that doesn't sound good for a start.
I like watching football on my own anyway.
Okay, the tactics again.
Just to focus. I can't be doing people chatting to me while I'm watching it, you know.
Yeah.
But I remember Franny Jeffers, who was at Charlton at the time, he was Everton money, he was texting me through the first half. And I was gutted for the lads, you know, who were friends of mine, because I knew how desperately they wanted it. And then I suppose at the end of the game, when the celebration started, it was the first moment in the evening where I was struggling a bit with it, thinking I should be there. So it was a really bittersweet evening. Mm. You know, I spoke to the boys after to congratulate them. And, you know, I could feel their joy. It was, when you care for people, you can only be happy for them, because, you know, I've spent a lot of time with Karen and Stevie. But there was a part of me that was sick. There was a part of me that was gutted that I wasn't part of it. But then you have to just quickly get to a point where you go, took a while, by the way, where you go, you know what? Someone said to me, you're going to have 6 years, whatever it was, at Liverpool and win trophies in the play with the shirt on of the team you love, play in front of the cop, you know, score at Old Trafford, Goodison, whatever. I mean, come on. I mean, I'd have snatched your hand off. It's be thankful what you've had, not what you didn't have, you know?
No, it's true. You're in the 0.0001% of everyone who's had that dream, you know? We're not crying tears for you either, but it's tough. It is tough. It is tough. You mentioned Carragher.
It was a tough one.
Yeah, I can imagine. You mentioned Carragher and Gerrard there and the closeness. What friendships have survived moving on and survived retirement? Because we often hear, you know, footballers really tight and then it just drifts. So which friendships have survived for you over the last decade or so?
Well, I'm still in touch with them.
Right.
As the years have gone on, some years would be, you know, you'd see or speak to them more than others, depending on circumstances and busyness and family and kids being born and God knows what. But Cara and Steve, Cara, you know, we're in the same field. You know, we message, we speak. Stevie, obviously, in management. I saw Stevie recently, actually, at Gerard Houllier's memorial. It was great to see him and Gary Mack. So, yeah, me and Stevie swap messages. I don't get to meet up with them very often. Obviously, I mean, it's been impossible anyway with COVID, as you know. But, yeah, so Stevie and Cara, I've maintained a friendship with. Other than that, you get this world now where you stay in touch on social media. You know, John Arisa, Sammy Hippier, Jersey Dudek, whose birthday it is today. Happy birthday, Jersey. People, you know, the social media keeps you active with others and seeing how their lives are. But probably those two being the main two, because of Michael I still see on the media circuit. Michael, I still, you know, if I need a favour, I'll give him a shout. I need something signed or a tip on a horse race, I might give him a text. But, you know, it's hard life. You move on and location wise. But yeah, I was the first to, you know, one of the first to send Stevie a message, congratulate him on the winning the league, of course. And Cara, I'm in touch with a lot because we share views on what we see on the on the media circuit. Normally the same views, actually, to be fair to me and Cara.
Good. It's funny, we never know what's going on in a footballer's life. So I know at Charlton you enjoyed that year, maybe second year less so, and end up at Spurs. And the sense I'd always had, just, I'm not even sure where you pick it up, a headline here or there, was that there'd been a falling out with Martin Yall, or that, you know, they just hadn't worked out in those kind of 19 months. And then just in advance of talking to you today, had a deeper look, and it's something completely unconnected with anything a fan might see. And it was the very sad passing of your father prematurely, and that understandably knocked you for six. That happened right in the kind of heart of your time at Spurs. And, you know, again, looking in on the outside, I had no memory of that. I just thought God didn't really work out from at Spurs for whatever reason.
I didn't talk about it, that's why. Maybe I should have. So I went in the January, which is never a good thing to do. Sure. And Tottenham were doing really well. So I was bought really for the next season, because there was a huge confidence around the club that we were going to be in the Champions League and the squad was going to have to be better. The start of that second season, my daughter was born, which was a big thing as well. So that preoccupied me a little bit, as you can imagine. But then I got a little run in the team and started showing some form. And then, my old man got ill really quickly and out of the blue. And, of course, I spent time with him up until he passed, which was a massive chunk of time in terms of the football world. It was probably, I don't know, say it was a month. Training and emotionally, of course, it takes its toll. What you don't realise at the time, once he'd passed and I was desperately wanting to get back and occupy myself, is that I didn't realise the effect it had had on me, not just physically, but emotionally as well. It was only years later I could look back and try and judge that. And of course, blaming somebody was easier in terms of falling out with Martin and, you know, why aren't you playing me? Why are you playing him, et cetera, et cetera? And you don't want to take responsibility. But I suppose in life, you know, when wisdom comes to you as you get a bit older, you can look back and see what really went on. Yeah, I was in a ridiculously difficult position to try and play my best football. And probably the one thing I didn't do, which I chose not to, and I can't really think why. I suppose I didn't want everybody giving me sympathy, I chose not to speak. So then when I decided to leave Spurs because I'd kind of fallen back in the pecking order and not playing, because I love playing, a lot of clubs were saying to me and my agent, well, what's happened? And then I had to kind of explain the situation because, as you well rightly said, it looked like I'd just fallen off the cliff. And then I got the move to Fulham, and I have to say that the hierarchy at Tottenham were brilliant in making that. And Martin and I didn't fall out. We shook hands at the end. We had our words during my time there. But as I said, I have to take some responsibility for that.
So it was
a difficult time. And probably the one biggest regret in my career is not showing the Tottenham fans, other than probably four or five games, what I could really do.
And it would have suited you down to the ground, that fans. Club and that style of football as well. You know, I mean, it looked like a good match.
Indeed. Good players. They had a lot going on. Carrick was there, Edgar was there, Lennon, Keno. Berber was there. Keno was brilliant with me as well because, you know, he'd lost his dad years earlier, so he understood, became a really good friend of mine, Robbie. It was a nice friendship to have in that moment, great support. But the club was phenomenal. It was brilliant place to work, and I deeply regret not showing the fans that I had more to offer.
Yeah, well, I'm sure they understand. And it's interesting, so like this macho environment as well, and you mentioned Robbie Keane's father had passed far too soon as well. So when you say support, I mean, is that like a, come on, let's go out and have a few beers and just, get off our heads?
And also talking about it.
Proper, let's have a heart-to-heart. Let's try and how you feel and tell me your emotions.
No, even in a jokey way. Even in a matter-of-fact way. You know, like bringing up the subject of someone's death is very difficult. I mean, it's obviously we've all got different stories, but what the normal thing was when I went back was a lot of lads just to be a little bit, sensitive.
And
you know, Danny, you're right. Yeah, all right. And then their head goes down and... Whereas Keno would just openly talk about it. He would, you know, and then I might not play for a couple of weeks, or I'm on the bench, and, you know, he'd say to me, come on, you're coming to mine, we're going out, we're going to have some food and have a few beers, we'll have a night out. You know, even made me wear his gear one night. That's a different story.
That's a bit much.
Do you know what? I'll tell you that quickly. We went out one night, he was trying to cheer me up, to be fair. Well, I hadn't played, I got over my old man and that, and we went out, and I had no stuff. And he said, well, we're similar size, you can wear my gear. And the short version is that we're in a bar and we got talking to a few girls, and I'll never forget that one of them decided to lay into my gear. And Keno was not best pleased, let me tell you. But the irony was, I was finding it hilarious, even though she was having to go at my, well, what I was wearing. So, yeah, that was Keno all over. He was great fun, great support.
Yeah, I can imagine that was important. This era we're talking about, by the way, I mean, geez, I to play through it must have been fun. It was even great just to be able to watch it. You're talking that late 90s into the 99 United treble winning era. You've got the Arsenal Invincibles, as you mentioned. You're then into Mourinho and Chelsea, and then United come back with Ronaldo and Rooney and Tevez. And I think Fergie retires the same year as you, and Man City are on the scene. That's a lot of proper teams you're against, a lot of brilliant opponents. And I hate the, you know, best opponent question, so I don't want to put it like that. But Who are the ones you really remember thinking, when I'm at my best and he's at his best, this is great fun, us two going head to head?
It's difficult at times because a lot of the times you can admire players and you're on the same pitch and their brilliance is obvious, but you're not up against them.
Yes.
So there's wonderful talent that you come up against. And, you know, there's so many players that you could reel off, the best midfielders with this country's seen. But I always struggled a bit with Scholes. I try and go after him and get after him and let him know you're there and he'd play around you. Sit off him and he'd hurt you with his passing and spray it and play past you. And Carrick was another one I didn't like playing against. Very intelligent, always knew when to come after you, when to drop off, read your passes, always be thinking one step ahead.
Right.
And probably those two come to mind because they were playing for Man U, who were so successful. I didn't play too many times in central midfield up against the likes of, a couple of times I did Vieira, but it wasn't the same. I never felt like he could hurt you as much. Scholes was the one who you'd come off the pitch thinking he's just ran the whole show, he's ran the game. Of course, Stevie was a difficult opponent, but I always felt more comfortable playing against Stevie than I did some of the other players I mentioned, even though I think Stevie's the best midfielder the Premier League's ever seen. Mm. Because I knew him, it didn't feel as difficult. It felt like I knew what he was going to do and I felt like more comfortable against Stevie. So Scholes, he was probably the one. The one player I'd say that in my later years, playing for Fulham in a holding role,
yeah.
The one player who probably, strangely this one might sound, Tim Cahill. He was absolutely brilliantly disciplined at stopping me playing.
Right.
And in a very clever way. He'd mark you the wrong side. He'd come at you late. He'd try different ways of stopping you playing and getting on the ball. And then, of course, when you think you've got him, when he's playing in that 10 role, he'd be off your shoulder and he'd be on the back post scoring.
Yeah.
He was probably, in my later years, the one player I used to think, oh, no, not today. Mm. Can't be dealing with Tim today.
See, that's a brilliant answer because you could have said, you know, the usual suspects, but Carrick and his thinking and being one step ahead, I think you have to be on a pitch with someone to fully sense that, and Cahill would have never jumped to my mind either. That intelligence is almost what you respect as much as anything out there.
Correct. And Carrick was really, really good at that. When I'm on the ball, he would even look, he'd be looking at, it's like even like a wry smile as if to say, I know what you're thinking. Don't play it there because I'll have it. And then you end up thinking to yourself, is he thinking that or is he not? And hopefully, maybe some respect the other way, he was, you know, the same thing. But
I
used to think he knows what I'm thinking here, so I'll second guess what I'm going to do. Mm. And more often than not, he'd end up be intercepting balls that you never thought he'd know were going to happen. So Carrick was a really special player. United still haven't replaced him.
Mm. That must be one of the real joys of playing at that level. Everybody's technically proficient, and I can almost sense you on the pitch scanning who are the brains out here, the Carricks, the Cahills, those kind of guys. Who did you click with in terms of a telepathic relationship as a teammate? Who was that one that you were like, I know what he's going to do, he knows what I'm going to do, this is just heaven?
I had a real purple patch with Bentley at Charlton. Really purple patch. I was playing in a number 10 role. And he was playing high up and I just knew where he was going to run the whole time.
Mm. Did you talk about it off the pitch? Didn't need to?
Not really. No, because he was very good. Bentley knew what he couldn't do. He didn't come and try and look good. He wouldn't come and show and play round corners and bounce it off him. As soon as I got the ball, he's spinning and he's running and he's making good runs. I knew his runs. I knew where to put the ball. Mm. So we had a really purple patch together. Of course, Michael was easy to play with, likes of Fowler and even Keno. Keno was a joy to play with. His movement was phenomenal, Keno. But I didn't play enough with him to have that that great connection. So Bentley, I mean, Andy Johnson at Fulham, we had a good little relationship going on when he was fit. Very similar to Bentley, play off the shoulders and make good passes, bad passes look good.
Mm. Roy Hodgson is 73 years of age. He's managed 1,000 professional matches, still in the Premier League, not just managing any old team, he's still in the Premier League, which is nuts. This is the great Indian summer of your career, isn't it? This really kind of, I don't know, cements a certain quality that, you know, people, because not that Charlton was beneath you, but you were like, you were just such a, you were a brilliant player at Liverpool, and you were unlucky with England. That was a golden generation, and your metatarsal did its thing in 02, and you were clearly like best player at Charlton in many ways, and then Spurs didn't work out for reasons we've discussed. And I kind of think if it had drifted away there, that might have been unfulfilled. And yet those 5 years at Fulham, I felt almost reinstated, for in case there were any doubts, this guy was a quality player. I suspect important to you in that way too.
Yeah, it's a great point you make. I had to reinvent myself a little bit and show people that, you know what, remind people. I wasn't thinking that when I was trying to get back to playing well and you know, making an impact. But I certainly had a hunger in me still then, which probably came from the things you said. The first season was really difficult. We stayed up last day when I got the goal at Portsmouth, and Laurie Sanchez wasn't on the same page as me in terms of how we wanted to play. Of course not. But when Roy came in, he made some really astute signings: Schwartz, Andy Johnson, Bobby Zamora, Gira, people like Damien Duff. And the way he played was very similar to Julio. We didn't quite have the Liverpool quality, but well-organised, good professionals, players who want to do the right things, working together, training well. It fit. It was a perfect fit for what I needed at the time. He gave me the armband. I felt fit and comfortable, and everything was fine at home. I was starting to influence games and dictate games in a midfield role, a central midfield role, where I had to curb my enthusiasm to go and try and score goals and make things happen so much and just leave that to others. That was the biggest challenge for me, in that I'd always been somebody who could make goals and score goals. I still made chances in that role at Fulham, but I was not scoring as much. You know, I wasn't, my role changed, and I had to really fight hard to change my game. And then when I got comfortable in that role, I started realising that I could impact others with my organisation, encouragement, whatever it was. And it just became a real enjoyable place to play football.
Yeah.
It was a great ground in terms of, it was always full. There wasn't a high expectancy. There was a team that believed in what the manager wanted. There was good experience. There was a really nice atmosphere to play your football, and we thrived. We really did.
It sounds good. All those things are like everything you say that Hodgson puts in place. On paper, they make perfect sense, and you would think, well, everyone should go and do that. And clearly, it's so much more difficult than it would seem. We had Stephen Kelly on not so long ago. Obviously, you know, get the Irish guys on quite a bit, and the Europa.
Well, I'm nearly Irish. My dad was born in Cork.
Is that right?
Jeez. Yeah, he came over here when he was a baby, not come over
and got 100 Ireland caps for us. No,
do you know what? when I was made aware that I could, I was already disqualified being able to do so, because back then I'd played for England under 18s or 20s in a tournament, World Youth Cup, I think. So that disqualified me from even having the choice.
Right. So Stephen Kelly was on. He was talking. It was the anniversary last year of the Europa League final run, all the way through to Atletico. And look, there's a lot of great. The Juventus game looms large, and there's you beat Hamburg, German champions, and at that Atletico team, obviously, all those players went on to become household names in a massive way. And yet, Stephen Kelly was adamant. He said, "Forget about just that season." He said, "I think the best team I've ever played against was Shakhtar. That you have no idea. I've no memory of this game." But I heard you say, I think you were talking to Jimmy Bullard. I listened to a podcast you'd done a while back, which was great. He's mad as a box of frogs in a wonderful way, isn't he? But you were saying something similar. I think Fernandinho and Douglas Costa and Willian, and it was just bum, 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 and chasing shadows for a lot of it.
If you ever want to watch a game of football where you see how important a coach is and what they do on a training pitch, is follow them at home to Shakhtar Donetsk.
Okay.
So we score early on and late on. Scored in the first minute, and Bobby scored a wonder goal late on, and we beat them 2-1. But the majority of the game was them playing wonderful football against a super well-drilled, organised, good communicators, senior players, knowing our jobs. They play through and around, bap, 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 unbelievable technical football. And we stay patient. We stay with the job in hand. We stay with the orders from the manager. We stay close. We stay compact. We don't get angry. We don't get frustrated. We don't get worried about the crowd moaning and groaning that we can't get the ball, don't come out of position. We stay disciplined. It's a phenomenal example of what a well-coached football team can achieve against a technically superior football team on the same pitch.
Really interesting. God, like there's a gazillion things I want to ask you. I won't get to them all. I'm curious on England, and you were around the time of that golden generation, you know, and all the hype. Were you sitting there with your, you know, understanding of, you know, I think in at Crewe you played in a midfield three, so you understood the different ways football could be played from a young age. Did you look at this rigid 4-4-2 and look at Sven and say, this is not going to cut it? This is not going to cut it. There's a, if Lampard and Gerrard have been outplayed, then there's something wrong here tactically, or what were your thoughts around that time?
There was always conversations, yeah, some of the lads saying, maybe, you know, why should try and tweak it, or, you know, why doesn't he play him there and him there? And there were conversations, but ultimately, I think the quality they had in the team, they still believed they could win playing that way.
Okay.
And there was a belief that with, if you play Michael, he had to play with somebody. Now, Michael's talent, that's not right. Michael would have been fine on his own. Yes, Heskey helped him. But if you're talking about playing Scholes, Gerrard, Lampard in a three and playing Beckham wide right, maybe Joe Cole wide left or Kieran Dyer, whoever it was, you change the whole dynamic of the team, and the supply would have come to Michael through other areas. I think it was because Sven thought Michael needed a meal, and he didn't really want to play Beckham in a different position to what he did at Man United, and because he was so influential. But ultimately, yeah, we did think that. I did think that. But in the moment, you only think it per each game comes along, and you could have done better in that game, or maybe if we'd have played that way. I think only now, looking back, you can, and the way football's evolved, that conversation's become more prevalent.
Mm. A final point then on Crewe, and you said, if anyone's just joining us, talking to Danny Murphy here, where he came through at Crewe and made his senior debut at 16. In so many ways, they were ahead of their time, you know, modelled on Ajax, and you were playing in different positions and time with the ball, and clearly did so many things right. And I know you have a huge amount of time for Dario Gradi and the impact he had in your career. Obviously, it's been just desperately sad more than anything over the last couple of years to see the players coming forward and talking about the abuse they suffered. I know on Wednesday, an independent review, for instance, of Gradi, who was Crewe's manager from 83 to 07, they said he should have done more to investigate concerns about Barry Bunnell. But they did stress he wasn't involved in a cover-up. So we should stress that point as well. It's such a mess. I mean, you know, if, like it or not, Grady's now associated with it in the public eye, and I'm sure that's a source of sadness to you. And it's just horrific. I know you said a couple of years ago when it all started coming out into the public, you weren't shocked. You'd obviously heard whispers or rumour of some sort, Danny.
Well, we were interviewed in the 90s by the police, you know, when it first came out, while I was at Crewe.
Right, okay.
After he'd left, there was some rumours about, you know, the certain things. But when you're a young child, I went to Crewe when I was about 13, 12, 13. So when he'd left, I was probably 14, 15. You hear the odd thing, but there was... you're so focused on your own world and your own bubble that, sure, you know, you're not capable of taking any action or investigating. That's not your job to. But yeah, there was rumours. And then, of course, a bit later on when it got exposed in the 90s, we were interviewed and the things started coming out. But the thing to say for me is really simple. And I spoke about this in my column on Sunday. For a lot of people, a lot of young lads, and this doesn't hide from the fact and the problems that were at Crewe, and the way they've dealt with it's not been very good. I must repeat that.
Yeah.
But for me and lots of others, the environment was very safe and enjoyable and very beneficial. Now, that's the way it should be for all kids. And any wrongdoing or any cover-ups or any... things that can be learned or punished should be. I'm all for that.
Mm.
It's a situation that's horrendous for the club. It's horrendous for the people involved. But as you said, Dario was not an abuser. He's apologised for not doing. He says he wasn't aware, and he could have. I don't think that man, knowing him like I do, would have let children be abused or hurt if he thought that's what was happening. I can't believe that. From the man I spent years with, he's a very caring man. I don't believe for one second that that's the case. Now, could he have done things differently and investigated things more? Yes, probably. Do I think that haunts him? Probably. And he doesn't sleep at night thinking about what he could have and should have done? Probably. But all I can talk about is my own experience. It doesn't mean that some of the lads, and friends of mine, by the way, some of the lads involved are friends of mine. I feel their pain, and it doesn't help them that I had a good experience. It doesn't help them that other kids didn't have to suffer this. That doesn't help them, and I understand the need for justice. But I do. I have to say, from my experience, that the crew academy and the crew journey that I went on was very beneficial and very enjoyable for me.
I guess you have to count yourself extremely lucky, don't you? I think your time in Bunnell's coincided for maybe a year or so, and he was around.
I stayed at his house.
Wow.
I stayed at his house one evening. One evening I stayed at his house. It was a very normal evening. I didn't suspect a thing.
Right.
I didn't have a bad experience. I know what a monster he is, by the way.
Yeah.
I know. I mean, do you think my parents would let me stay there if they thought he was a monster? Now, there is always an argument of why coaches let players stay at the houses, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we're talking a long time ago where life was very different. It wouldn't happen now. But yeah, I feel lucky that I wasn't involved in his web of abhorrent behaviour and abuse. I mean, I was lucky, yeah. I do feel lucky.
God, staying at his house, that's a chilling thought now, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. But it's my main concern is for the lads. The bravery they've showed in coming out is phenomenal. I think it's been a brilliant thing that the lads did to come out and then help others come out and talk about these problems and hopefully get to a point where we are not worried about our children going to play football. Because that's just beyond where we ever should be.
It's difficult to segue away from that topic. It's so serious and you know, dwarfs everything else we're talking about, but I'll do it nonetheless. As we look to the future, brilliant pundit that you are, should you not be in management, really? Do you, like, you must have that itch to scratch, I would have thought.
I thought that would be the way I would go. Started on the journey of my badges. Nothing quite happened. The media work started by accident, really. A little bit of fun. Started getting asked to do more. And then when Brendan was at Liverpool, Brendan Rodgers, he changed his staff, if you remember. And I went to see him. And I had a chat with him about taking on a role, which filled me with excitement. But Gary Mack got the job ahead of me, which was fine. And Brendan phoned me and explained, and I was appreciative of the opportunity. But that was probably the only time I was given an opportunity that I thought that I might really be able to enjoy and get my teeth into. And then over time, when the media stuff started progressing and I was enjoying it, and I found a nice life balance in terms of spending time with my kids.
Right.
And family, playing golf and doing that. You know, I moved away from the idea of coaching and management to a degree because of the instability of it, the stress levels of it, and of course the fact that if you take on any job at any level, you're 7 days a week. And for me, the balance of spending time with my children, and especially after the breakup of my marriage and stuff like that, it was priorities. And the media work gives me the opportunity to spend tremendously good quality time with my children.
Yeah, I guess you'll never regret that. And the last one then, how did you, this is probably, it's a big question, but curious. How did you find that transition from adulation, ridiculous amounts of money arriving into your bank account, everything done for you, to real world former footballer Danny Murphy?
Initially, fine. It's like a break, like a holiday. Bit of media work, enjoying your freedom, drink when you want, party when you want, play golf when you want, go on holiday when you want. And a couple of years in, I hit a brick wall, to be honest, yeah. Found it really, really tough. Didn't really understand why. Didn't, you know, started going down a destructive path, really.
And without prying, what's a destructive path entail?
Just putting me first, you know, going out too much, drinking too much, self-indulgement, you know, not thinking about, just all about me.
Yes.
And not understanding why I was looking for escapism. So with a bit of help, friends and support, I got some professional help, did a bit of therapy, spoke out to people, and quickly found myself in a better place. I was brave enough to do that. I think it's a lot of mental health conversations around at the moment, and I think that's great that players are talking more. But I think it's very difficult to try and enlighten a player who's playing the game what's going to come.
Yeah,
I think it's really hard to give them the reality of that, because it hits you like a sledgehammer. It's just when it hits you.
Mm.
How do you occupy yourself? How do you not get into a position where when it hits you, you're in a good position to be able to deal with it.
So
it was difficult for a while. Thankfully I came through that and feel better because of that, actually understanding it, talking about it, and actually just getting to a point where you can be comfortable with what you're doing now and not reminisce and think, oh, you know, my life's over because I can't play football anymore. Well, I can still play, but not very well. I think it's good to talk, and I think it's good that people are able to share that they might need some help and get some help.
Yeah,
it's nothing wrong with asking for help.
No, far from it. It's far more common, I suspect, than we all think. Because you wouldn't have had therapy after your father's passing, for instance.
No, and grieving is a process that's difficult for anybody and then very different for people. That was part of it, of course. I'd put that to bed, hadn't I? I'd not dealt with it. There's lots of other aspects. The adulation you talk about, the financial clarity comes into play of what's been going on during your career. There's people out there who are, financially abusing footballers. We talk about sexual abuse, but financial abuse is rife in the game.
I bet.
That was part of it. All these things come into play, and I think we're in a better place now for ex-footballers to come out of the game and actually be able to find solace in certain other footballers or establishments or organisations. I think we're getting better.
Good. Well, listen, I've kept you slightly longer than planned, but it was absolutely fascinating. Thoroughly enjoyed the chat. Danny Murphy, such a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Cheers. Danny Murphy there with us, and it's part of our Paddy Power special here on Off the Ball this evening. With Paddy Power's ACCA Cracker, you can insure your ACCA. If one leg of your four legs or more ACCA lets you down, you get your stake back as a free bet. It's available in all football matches and markets. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. And just in light of the discussion we had towards the end there with Danny on Crewe, if you do need to talk to someone about child sexual abuse or you were affected by the conversation, then 1 in 4 are available on 01662 4070. That's 01662 4070.
With guilt like your eyes.